Hi, I'm Ray Reagans.
And I'm Ezra Zuckerman Sivan. And this is Outsider
Insider.
Ezra, why are we here?
Great question, Ray. We're here because of the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th and the suffering that unfolded from that. And then Israel's counterattack shortly after and the ongoing suffering from that. And then we're talking, you know, that's one part of the world, but the aftershocks, after effects throughout the world, transformative in a lot of ways, particularly on American campuses.
Members of the Jewish community were affected, but they didn't feel like they were being supported by other members of the MIT community.
And they weren't the only ones who had similar kinds of feelings. People, you know, Middle Eastern, North African, particularly Palestinians, might have felt something similar, symmetric, you might say.
That's right. These events in the Middle East had an effect on our community. And we wanted to understand why and how. And perhaps we could provide people with some tools for navigating these kinds of very difficult, challenging situations.
So, question we had last episode, right, was why is it that a lot of Jews felt the way they did about an event halfway across the world, even when they didn't have any close friends or family that were impacted on that day? And why is it that people who were not Jewish didn't seem to get why it was so? And maybe even those people who cared about them didn't reach out necessarily and say, you know, how are you doing? Can I help? And that, strangely, I think, took us to something you said to me, I don't know what it was, half a year prior to that. I kept coming back, trying and wrestling with why it is that there was this disconnect, right, between these American Jews who were hurting and their people who cared about them who didn't reach out. I kept coming back to a comment you made. You remember this, Ray?
I think I do remember the comment, Ezra.
Oh, I'm not surprised that you remember.
I have a good memory.
Yeah. So you said to me,
well, we were in a seminar. We were talking about the importance of, you know, family for educational outcomes among Jews.
Right.
And I said, I can't imagine a group of people for whom family matters less.
Right. And I fell off my chair.
And well, first you wanted to make sure that you heard me correctly.
That's right.
That's right.
Exactly. That's right. And that's true. When I tell the story to a lot of other people, they have the same reaction. And that, so what I, hearing that, at first I said, that can't be right. But Ray is saying, he must mean the opposite, right? But when I start thought about it a little more, I'm like, huh, Ray's onto something maybe. And then that came back to it after October 7th. And I realized you're onto something really deep. Despite the fact that, Ray, I don't believe you're Jewish. Is that right, Ray?
No, I'm not Jewish.
Okay, so there's something we didn't tell people, which was in thinking about this.
Don't you think we should tie it together for them first?
Oh, yeah.
The whole idea of peoplehood.
Peoplehood.
It turns out there's something called the idea of peoplehood for Jews, right? And it's a thing that binds them together that helped us understand why Jews in America would be so affected by this event in the Middle East, even if they didn't have, quote, family members who were directly affected by
exactly.
it.
But maybe the most interesting part, a lot of interesting parts, right, is that people may not themselves get how they're going to feel, members of the group. And it might take an outsider to kind of like point out something about that kind of connection.
As our good friend and colleague Roberto Fernandez would say, the fish takes the water for granted.
There you go. And right, you know, we could teach something to the fish by talking to the fish if we could. And maybe the fish could teach us something about ourselves if we could talk.
Okay, bad analogy.
No,
bad analogy.
I liked it. Right.
But we take things for granted. There are things about us that are so important to us, and yet we take it for granted.
Yep. So in episode one, we look back at a key moment where Ray, from an, you might say, outside in perspective, allowed me to learn something about myself and helped both of us gain some insight into the question of why people who care may not have reached out to support those whom they care about.
And there's a symmetry in this episode, Ezra. as we began to talk more about peoplehood, you prompted me to learn something about myself by making a reference to Black family reunions. And as we began to read about and investigate that, I not only learned something about the idea of the extended family in general for members of the Black community, but about my own family.
Yeah. So I would say, I mean, one way to think about what we're going to talk about today, right, is I think the ball that we hit last episode was about what family means, right? We, I think, were basically allowing the audience to think, you know, family is family is family. And maybe like you said, when you were reacting to that, you know, seminars, like that what we're talking about is nuclear family, right? But when we came back to, you know, the you know, the insight that you had and how it was relevant, we were wrestling through, I said something to you, Ray, right? That you had almost kind of a similar reaction to when I said it to you.
I don't think I had a similar reaction.
All right.
Because I think you were at least curious about what I had to say. When you said what you said to me, I totally dismissed it.
All right. Well, you want to own that. That's fine.
I'll own it.
Okay, fine. I would say there's a beautiful symmetry there, right?
Okay.
Even if the symmetry doesn't mean it's exactly the same.
Ah, you're just better at hiding your reactions than I am.
All right. So we got to tell people what it was that I said and how your reaction was, right? So I said, actually, to this, I don't remember the words I said, but I said something like, you know, Ray, this reminds me of, you know, something that I've seen, I thought about Black family reunions. And my Black family reunions are really interesting, right? And it can sort of have something to teach us about, right. And so people can't see your face right now, right? You're like, what is Ezra talking about, right?
I haven't reconsidered it.
We're going to talk about that too. Right. But I'm like, yeah. You know, Black family reunions are really, you know, my impression is, and this is like, it was for me, a little bit like you had a gut impression of what family meant to American Jews, right? And how that, you know, and it didn't have the, I think, the language for peoplehood yet, right? But we worked through that. And I had just a gut reaction from stuff that I had seen, right? About like, where have I even seen this? Like, I think, you know, I'm not a member of a Black family, but I definitely seen various times, like, especially like, I don't know, in hotels, I've been on the road over a weekend.
Yeah. Doing your travel.
Exactly.
You come across these things.
Right. And the most, you know, what's the most distinctive thing about Black family reunions, at least for an outsider, but you said the same thing, right, Ray?
The t-shirt thing? And it's funny, I had that reaction. Because a feature of Black family reunions is people end up with a t-shirt that has a name on it, or maybe a few names on it. And it wasn't just me, Ezra. Like, you've shared this, right? And I've shared it with a number of Black people. And they all had the same, I'm going to say uniformly, had the same reaction. The t-shirt thing? Yeah, the t-shirt thing. Well, I have to tell you, the t-shirt thing. And so, you know, you shared it with me, Black family, what? And so that was my reaction.
Yeah.
But then again, this is my friend, right? This is Ezra, right? And I can't believe I'm saying this, right? 99% of the time, this guy has something interesting to say. And so my instinct said,
99 might be a little bit high, right?
I didn't say right. I said interesting.
Interesting.
You
know,
you
could
be wrong and be interesting.
Interestingly wrong. Good. That's good.
Interesting wrong, right? This felt like it was in that category.
Yeah.
And so then I started reading on it. I started reading about Black family reunions, and I came across something.
Yeah.
And it was slaves after emancipation and their last names. Like, my last name is Reagans. I've spent my whole life thinking that my last name was given to me, right? That slaves were emancipated. They got the last name of their previous slave owner. Their master. They got their master's name.
Right.
And that's been my understanding of my last name.
And Ray, it's important, I think, to remind people, right, that slaves didn't have last names, right?
They didn't have last names. They had first names.
Right.
Right. We can talk about that in a minute, about this two-name system, but let's just the surprise of it.
Yeah.
And it was, no, that these emancipated people chose their last name. What? Like, when given the choice of a last name, they picked the last name of their master. And this just blew me away. And
Not always, right? But even that it happened at all, even once, would be amazing, right?
If the fact that it happened once.
Right, right.
Okay, more than once. But that it was a thing
right.
that happened. And so, why? Became the question. And you had this a similar response to it. Why?
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out there's a reason. There's a logical reason. And it's because they were trying to find their family members. And they're trying, imagine someone searching for me. How would they know? How would they find me? And so at least for some, the last name of the master would be a good indicator of that might be your family member. That was the logic that people were using.
Yeah. Ray, what I understand about that is like, it's almost like there's two kind of things going on, right? At that moment where you gain your freedom, right? As a former slave, right? One is just the fact of having a last name, any last name, is a mark of freedom, right? Because you were, you know, you didn't have a last name basically because, and it's a way of keeping family members apart. It's a way of treating him like property, right? And so having a last name, you become a citizen. You become actually a free, independent family, right? And then why would you, given all that, like you're saying, why, how could you possibly ever, you know, pick the slave master's name? Well, you might if you had been, family been separated, you're trying to find with them, and that's the only name that you know as a way of finding each other, you are going to pick a name that, like, that would be a good reason to do it, right?
That they would know.
That they would know to find each other.
Think about it, that they would to find each other. It's an issue of search, right? I'm trying to find my people. How could they find me? How could I find them?
Yeah.
And so they picked this last name. So it turns out it's true. It happened in some cases, but it turns out it wasn't as widespread as what, at least what I thought initially when I was so surprised by it.
Right.
But they did pick the last names of whites locally. When given the choice of picking a last name, they picked the last names that were popular in their communities, which in itself becomes a very interesting thing because it turns out those names weren't so unique in their communities. And so this helps us to understand why blacks have, you know, Johnson, you know, Brown, you know, names like that, Jackson,
right,
are very popular in the African-American community to an extent that you don't see in the white community.
Yeah, and some of it is just those the prominent Americans' names, right? Even if they were complicit in slavery, right? But you've got, you know, the famous story about Booker T. Washington showing up at school and being asked for a last name, didn't have one, right? And so he picks George Washington's name.
He picks Washington.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, it's about mental availability.
Mm, right.
And what names are going to be available?
Right.
Right? The names of prominent people, the popular names in my neighborhood, in my broader community, and those were the names, the last names, that the emancipated people selected. We're in this name rabbit hole for at least a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And it's first names.
Yeah.
First names now. And this gets to something that you shared, in which I found interesting when you go look at it. You know, their first names like Caesar or Prince, the first names of slaves.
Yeah.
Or Moses, you know, biblical names.
Right.
And it turns out that, you know, those names were distinctive. They were different than the first names that whites had in the antebellum South. Right. And so this is a very interesting dynamic of naming and how it defines who we are as a community. And last little rift on the last names is that when the blacks started to adopt last names that were similar to whites, the whites started to adopt first names that were even more different than the first names.
Differentiation, we would call it, right?
Differentiation, right?
Yeah.
It's okay.
So you've got
the Black Family Reunion.
Right. But to build to that, right? So we've got a moment in which you're building a family, right? So let me ask you a question, Ray, telling people, I think I learned from the discussions with you, but people may not know. When people were building these families, and then, you know, there's a through line to these family reunions, you know, who's a member of the family? I think most people would imagine, like, who's a member of the family? Well, it's, you know, cousins, second cousins. It's all people who, like, and everyone has a clear idea of, like, how it is that you're kin with each other, blood kin.
That's
right. I think it's what most people would imagine.
So I had an image in my head of emancipated people. Wow, just think about that project. Okay, all of a sudden these folks are free and they manage to build a community, right? Social order. And on a time scale in my mind that's just hard for people to imagine. Okay? And so they're organized around churches. They might be looking for their real family, but what about the here and now? They needed support now. And so one place where they found support, quote, family, was the Black church.
Right, right. You got the Black church and you've also got, like, what we're calling, you know, family, that's actually people relating to each other like members of an extended family, right?
That's right. So it seems that on plantations, there was a sense of extended family, where so much so that some of the stuff I was reading, it was natural for children to call adults, you know, auntie or uncle on the plantation. So there was already this sense of extended family that existed on the plantation that, you know, became even more important after, it would seem.
Right. And so this is a little different kind of, we use the anthropological term fictive kin, right? This is someone specific in a specific kind of role, aunt or uncle, like you're saying, you're relating to them as if they are kind of blood kin, but they're not blood kin. And there was a lot of that, right?
They're family relationships that exist.
Yeah.
And we would assign those relationships to people, but knowing that, like, biologically, that's not true.
Right.
But we would treat them as if.
As if.
Right?
Yep.
They were my aunt, or as if they were my uncle. That's what we mean by when we say the idea of fictive kin.
I mean, there's work by this, you know, great anthropologist, Marshall Solins, where family has always been more than biology. And so the fiction is that family has been determined strictly by biology. It's always more than that.
You know, one thing that I've learned is I've learned more about my family. And, you know, one thing I learned, my mother's first cousin, Annie Pearl, who was more like her sister, and I can't even say it, Annie Pearl's not related to me. My mother's from West Texas. And there's a thing about Black people from the South and the 40s and 50s or 30s. They don't want to talk about the South, right? In general, it's just a painful time for them. When my mother left Texas, you know, the stories are, right, when she crossed the border, you know, she spat and said, I'm never going back.
Wow.
And she's never gone back to Texas.
Things are so much better in Kansas?
Things are so worse, so much worse in West Texas, all right?
Wow.
And so they just don't talk about it. So this is something people never talked about. And what I learned is that Annie Pearl wasn't my mother's first cousin, is that she was unrelated to my mother. My great-grandmother took in Annie Pearl's mother when that child's mother, these are all confusing to me, and I think it's perfect for what we're describing.
Yeah, wow.
Died, and she died in a field.
Wow.
And so my great-grandmother just took that child and raised that child as if she were her own. And Mama Neat is who that was. Mama Neat had Annie Pearl. Annie Pearl was like second mother to me. And I now know that. And it changes nothing about the fact that she's family to me.
Right. Fact. So could I just say, as the outsider in this conversation, first of all, I wish people could see the smile on your face as you're telling the story. But the second thing, I think what you're emphasizing, right, is like the intergenerational aspect of it. So this is a you know, a bringing into, like, a forging of a family connection, which is family, using the frame of family,
right,
this fictive kin. And that's carried down through, what are we talking, right, three generations?
Exactly. Because my great-grandmother raised her grandchildren.
Right.
And Annie Pearl would have been raised with them.
Wow.
All right. So it was nothing for a great-grandmother to be rearing her children's children. Right?
Wow. Yeah.
So that's a wonderful example of this whole idea of, I mean, we'll call it fictive kin, but a sense of extended family. that in many respects is unique, I'll use the word, is distinctive about the African-American experience.
So the way we were being kind of coy in the last episode is we were sort of like, family is family is family. This is not, you know, it's certainly not in my family experience like that. But I'm imagining, Ray, the reason connecting back to post-slavery is that we should, I think, imagine similar kinds of experiences that were bonding experiences, or people are forging family type connections in the unimaginably difficult conditions of slavery and the transition into emancipation. Then you got migration, right? You got the Great Migration, but you even got even smaller migrations just from you say West Texas to Kansas. And then you're forging those connections over time and space through a unique kind of family bond. Yeah.
Out of necessity. I mean, this is something that came up when we were talking about this and the Black church and the Black community that emerged out of emancipation. In some sense, it's out of necessity. Can you think of a more vivid example of a child being taken in and treated as a family member?
Yes.
That's necessity, right?
Yeah.
All right. So this whole idea of, you know, the extended family, you know, the fictive kin among African Americans. And so what does that have to do with Black family reunions? I'm telling you this story, but I think, no, it's not meant to be the equivalent of peoplehood in the way that we've discussed it for Jews in America or for some Jews.
Yeah.
But there is an element of it. And you can see that in the Black family reunions. You know, for one reason why, okay, I've never been to one. I was at one, but I didn't participate. And here's the reason why. The last name on the t-shirt wasn't my last name.
Right.
It wasn't my last name. It wasn't, this was through my grandmother. It wasn't her last name. I couldn't find anyone in my family tree, extended family, that had that last name.
So why were you invited?
Because it was a family reunion in Oklahoma, and those people all considered themselves to be part of the same family. That's what I'm trying to get
Including
at.
You. They thought you were part of it too.
Well, it's my grandmother.
Yeah, right.
My grandmother, my aunties, my uncles, they all, this is our family. And I'm like, how is this our family? And no one can tell me the connection. No one could tell me the connection, by the way. Well, it's just our family.
Yeah.
And so, and they participated in it, and it was something they did whenever the reunion happened. For me, it didn't make sense then. It makes more sense now.
Why does it make more sense now, Ray?
Just imagine what it's like being in Oklahoma or West Texas. Right?
Yeah.
In the 20s, the 30s, the 40s.
Yeah.
We're talking Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And so these are people who've come together. All right. So I will tell you more. This happened. I was down in Oklahoma because my grandfather had just died and we were at his funeral and we had went off and me and my brothers went to go find lunch one day and we were in a restaurant. It took them like over an hour to finally serve us. We thought nothing of it. And when we came home, they asked us, where'd you go? And we told them where we went. And no one believed us. This is a crowd of people. They're like, finally, they said, they do not serve Black people in that restaurant.
Wow.
This was the 80s.
Wow.
I'm trying to give you a sense for what it was like. Right. And so those boundaries were still there in the 80s.
Essentially caste boundaries.
That's right. And they made no sense to me. Right. Me and my brothers, we just went.
Right.
But for them, they were still there. And they saw themselves as being basically an extended family.
And to the extended family that can support each other against a system that was just all stacked in a, you know, against them.
That's what I'm going to assume. I can't say that with certainty, but that's what I would assume because that's the image. I keep seeing this image of a picnic around a Black church and just, you know, the Hidden Figures. Did you see the movie, The Hidden Figures?
No.
All right. So this is about the Black women and their role in NASA getting us to the moon.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's an image of a picnic outside the church. That's what keeps coming to mind when we think about, when I think about emancipation, Black family reunions. It's an extended group who treat each other as kin in some way.
So it's just so interesting. Like that image you gave, it has so much overlap with what we talked about last episode about peoplehood, right? And then such interesting subtle difference, right? So let's just play that out a little bit more. A really interesting compare contrast with the experience and the kind of forging of a black of the black family, which is that. So okay, let's talk about Eastern European Jews and their experience with last names. And this also has a little bit of personal element for me because my name is kind of funky, right? Zuckerman Sivan. So Zuckerman was a name that was not my great-grandfather's, paternal great-grandfather's name when he left. He lived sort of what is today Vilnius, right? Which Jews and Poles called Vilna in the 1890 thereabouts, somewhere like that. And his name was Rumshinsky. His brother was actually a famous Yiddish composer in New York, Yosef Rumshinsky, and he was a simple man. But somehow he acquired the name Zuckerman along the way. These are known as Ellis Island stories in one way or another, even though they might have happened to the point of embarkation. So his one brother did keep the name Rumshinsky, I guess because it was kind of a stage name of some kind. It was important for his career. But all the other brothers had different names, Rumshin, Green, and everybody lost track of each other. Right. So they think like such a.
That's the opposite, right?
Yeah,
that's the fascinating. Opposite.
That's right. And my understanding of how and why that happens, right? So first of all, the most important fact that I was going to mention is that up until sometime in the 19th century, depends where, when you had emerging kind of, you had state building projects in Europe, especially now we're talking about Eastern Europe, and the notion that you would extend citizenship rights to all kinds of people, including even Jews, who historically had only collective rights and temporary rights to live in different locations in Europe. And by the way, the term emancipation is used to describe the extension of these citizens' rights to Jews throughout Europe. Up until that point, in Eastern Europe in particular, the Eastern European Jews had a way of relating to each other with names, which was basically in Hebrew and or Hebrew characters, name of child and then son of so-and-so or a daughter of so-and-so. And then it would use the father's name or the mother's name, depending on the context. In Arabic, I think that's true, similar kind of system. And that was the nomenclature people used, just like we were talking about West Africa, right, Ray? I mean, there was probably a wide variety of different kinds of indigenous naming logics and structures that were then used, but then people were ripped out of that system.
They had to create their own. I mean, and so you can imagine that there's some element that's a continuation, but which one? Like which feature of family from West Africa are we going to adopt?
There's at least two kind of reasons, in my understanding of it, as to why families like ours just kind of dropped their last names and picked up new ones. Maybe three reasons you could say, but in our case, two, right? One is they didn't feel like these last names were actually their names. They were alien to them. They were imposed on them, right? Number one. Number two.
This happened, by the way.
Yeah,
when the North was when they were emancipating slaves as they moved west, they were encountering people who had one name, but they had to keep track of them somewhere. They had to like document this person, and they were like, "You got to have a last name."
Right.
Some of the research I was reading was talked about how as they began to migrate north, you know, blacks began to then change their name to differentiate themselves from blacks who were in the South.
Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And in the Jewish case, some Jews would anglicize their names essentially to try to escape, to become more American and to try to escape discrimination, which they faced significantly. They were trying, they could try to basically assimilate in a way that blacks obviously couldn't, right? So here they are. They were for the most part impoverished immigrants needing each other in a way that you would think would be similar to the kind of needs that
with Black Americans.
Exactly. And, you know, this is just conjecture, I think. So why would they then, you know, not try to keep those last names in order to keep those bonds, right? And I think the main reason I would give is that they had peoplehood bonds as a substitute.
Interesting.
Right? And so, one way to think about that is there was an institution
called the Landsmannschaft, which means people from the same town.
That was very common among immigrant Eastern European Jews. My late father would tell me stories about picnics. He would go, I think annually there would be a picnic. When he was growing up in Brooklyn, they would meet other Jews who had emigrated from the same little village, a shtetl, called Lakach. They thought of themselves as members of a people, and they were particular, had shared memories from that town, but I think had every expectation that the next generations would forget about that in this one way or another, and maybe merge into a larger kind of memory life in Eastern Europe.
This is rich.
Yeah. And these are people who really were hoping that their children, I think for the most part, would retain their Jewish identity, but also were hoping they would have been Americanized, I think, and become, both of those things.
Yeah. Can we take a moment and say what we're saying, but what we're also not saying?
Please.
Is that we've talked about the importance of peoplehood and for Jews, and we've talked about this sense of fictive kin and extended family, for African Americans and the foundation for that. And we've pointed out some similarities.
Yeah.
But what we're not saying or not trying to say is that they're the same thing, because they're not.
Right.
What we're also not saying is that these logics are an essential feature of these groups. History matters. And so this discussion that we've had over the two episodes, we can see how the history of the Jewish experience shaped the idea of peoplehood, how the history of the Black American experience or the African American experience has shaped the idea of the extended family.
I think what we've learned together, right, is like you think about, I think we can strongly identify with human beings, groups of human beings in very, very trying circumstances historically, that basically any human beings would probably respond to those conditions in a similar kind of way. But the historical conditions have some similarities and they have some differences. And based on those similarities and differences, you can see how a distinctive way of bonding with each other, a distinctive logic kind of forms. In one case, the emphasis on peoplehood, in the other case, the emphasis on extended family with aspect of fictive kin, in some ways in both cases, right?
That's right.
And then, why do we care, right? At some level today, other than it's interesting, right? Going back to our problem, how do we see each other and help and support each other?
Let's not overlook the fact, and it's an important point that you made, is that these logics allow us to see when people from a group are more likely to feel a connection.
Right?
When they're more likely to feel a bond.
Yeah. And then, if we can understand the lenses that people are using, right, you can also be a little more sensitized to the lens that you happen to use, right, is, a distinctive lens. And
we're not saying that everyone has to use the same lens, is that it helps. It helps me understand the lens that you're using. And it helps you to understand the lens that I'm using. And I can't really understand my lens because I take it for granted. And so I need for you to provide that kind of clarity.
Right,
you need for me to do the same thing for you.
Need is a great word there. I love that. Yeah.
I love that word too.
Right. Yeah. And right. Couldn't see it on our own. Right. We need each other for that. And this is a good transition, Ray, I think, into where we're headed next.
Where are we headed next?
Good question. The place we're going is the place we've been the whole time, right? Which is the university, right? So I think if I had to sketch where we're going next, right? It's, here we are. You and I have this relationship, right?
We're leveraging our relationship.
Leveraging it to the hilt.
If you allow me my sociology for a minute, we're going to use our relationship as an ideal type. It's a type of relationship, a type of outsider-insider relationship that was created in a university setting. And that's, we're also going to treat that university setting as an ideal type. It's going to be the kind of place that brings people together who have very different and divergent experiences. But when it's doing its well, it can create the kind of relationship that we have.
Yeah, where you're not just kind of working together, but actually learning about each other in a kind of a deep way and about ourselves. So which is, what is it about universities that make them maybe uniquely able to bring people together who are as different, come from different backgrounds, just like you and I have, and what makes it so that the same institution has, challenges as universities had after October 7th?
I think that's right. In a sense, we're saying that our experiences led us to conclude that we can do better. And we're going to try to lean into this relationship that we have as a way of thinking about doing better, encouraging more people to build this kind of cross-cutting, boundary-spanning relationship.
Yeah, and we come away knowing a lot more about ourselves and each other than we'd otherwise would, right?
And our tendency, and we said this last time, I want to emphasize it, is during moments of crisis, our tendency is to look for and focus on people who are similar to us in some way.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's good and it's bad. It's good. People have, you need to have people you can bond with, like we're talking about, and can support each other. But the downside is not insignificant, right?
There is a downside. And you will miss these kinds of moments. The insights that an outsider could bring to members of a community that not only helps them understand who they are, but could also provide a foundation for relating to members of other groups.
Yeah.
And we lose those relationships, those important boundary-spanning relationships, you know, during a times of crisis.
Right. And I think if we can come to, you know, an appreciation for how it is that, like, things that trigger us, those kind of identity shocks, and how similar they are across different kinds of situations and groups, we can also come to a deeper understanding of it. We should mention, we'll put in the show's notes, there is very good research showing that this is a distinctive institution of That's Black right. America, right?
I think we want to make that point about many things that we've just touched on.
Yeah.
The whole idea of fictive kin, extended family.
Right.
There's wonderful research on the distinctive nature of Black names in the antebellum South. We have not done justice to them.
We'll dump a lot of research on people if they're interested to
That's
to
right. read,
right. Yeah.
There is wonderful research on that. And we only briefly touched on that.
Yeah. I'm Ray Reagans.
And I'm Ezra Zuckerman Sivan. And you've been listening to Outsider
Insider.
This is a podcast from MIT. We got some thank yous to do, right, Ray?
Yes, we do.
All right. So we want to give special thanks to the MIT Sloan School of Management, Dean Georgia Parakis in particular. And we also want to thank the Office of Communications and the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
You're welcome, right? Ezra.
For all the time and support that they provided for the podcast.
And we want to give a special shout out to the executive producer, Kate O'Sullivan. And this podcast was produced and edited by Lucy McCormick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy. With help from consulting producer, Maymay.
All right. And Ray, we could go on and on by the many colleagues who have been helping us. Couldn't do this without them. But, you know, for fear, we'll leave somebody out, which is very, very likely given how many people it is. Just a general shout out to all the people.
Let's just remind them that Harry Potter was nothing without his friends.
So Ray.
Yes, Ezra.
The big question, you know, is, you know, the one that I keep on asking for you. I want to know if you've changed your attitude towards it. Like, will you now answer that question differently? Now that you know what you know, will you be attending your family reunion the next time you're invited?
You know, I'm an academic. I enjoy learning more about a situation than actually experiencing the situation. So I'll give it some thought. If I do attend one of my Black family reunions, you know, I'll make sure to take notes.